on here. Good morning, everybody. Welcome, welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson, and where we talk about whatever the Risen Son of God is thinking or doing right now. What is that? What is that, Bruce?
I'm having a lot of fun with going through Gary Renard's fourth book, and I know we've been doing that for a while. So, unless you have some other late-breaking non-dual news, or other items of interest to people listening, and maybe we just dive right back in. What do you think?
Well, yeah. Other than to say happy birthday,
Charles.
I know it was yesterday, but I didn't have a chance to talk to you yesterday.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we had a fun day and goofed off a little bit and went for a hike in a new little trail nearby that we hadn't tried out, and hung out with friends, had dinner, and played games and dessert, and just kind of a nice, relaxing afternoon. So that's good.
Oh, awesome. That's perfect. So what kind of games did you play?
Oh, there's, what's it called? Quizzle? It's sort of like a dominoes game, only with tiles that have colored symbols on them, the different shapes and different colors. It's just a silly pastime kind of game, but it was fun to do something, miscellaneously trivial and silly.
What it is just communicating and being associated with the Christ.
It was just fun, a good excuse to hang out with our friends and visit, a bit more.
So,
yeah.
Exactly. So, well, cool. So, yes, we are in Gary Renard's fourth book, which is The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, History of Mighty Companions. And we're moving along now. We're on page 173, according to my count.
That's what I have, yeah. I think we finished it, actually.
Yeah, and let's see. So, yeah, we're having a conversation between Gary and Persa talking about the future and colonization of other planets and all kind of interesting stuff. So,
dive in?
Yeah, absolutely. And, okay. Since you seem to know where we're at, I'll let you start.
Okay. I'm going to back up a sentence, maybe a couple of paragraphs, to about the middle of 173, where, Persa jumps in and says, speaking of the level of the mind, the human race will continue to develop its mental abilities over the centuries. Gary, wait a minute. Over the centuries? Are you saying that the human race and the planet are going to survive for centuries? That's the most encouraging thing I've heard in a while. Persa, don't get all giddy about it. It won't be easy. There will be times when the human race will survive by the skin of its teeth. There's global warming, which will mess up the Earth's weather and topography, displacing many millions and killing many millions more. There are covert attempts to limit the world's population by making men sterile without them realizing it. There's the prospect not just of It gets better, don't worry. There's the prospect of not just nuclear terrorism, but also regional nuclear war, which could happen in several different areas. You have politicians in positions of power, and some who will be, who, for lack of a better term, are nut jobs.
When did he write this?
Let's see. I think this was written, let's look at the copyright date. It came out last year. But
it took a long time to get it depressed.
It did. 2017. So it's that's the copyright date. But I think most of this was written several years ago.
It was
over a period of years. Yes,
because I remember and all the trouble that he was having with the publishers. I think that people were thinking this stuff is outrageous and outlandish and. And this will never happen. And then it did, so.
Right. So it says, to put it in context, I'll read that last sentence again. You have politicians in positions of power, and some who will be, who, for lack of a better term, are nut jobs. That's not a judgment, just a logical extension of a thought system. Don't forget what the Course says about the ego. It is completely savage and completely insane. Humans are in for quite an adventure. The colonization of other planets will help ensure the survival of the race, making it more difficult for you to kill yourselves all at once. Gary. So, now with that out of the way, first about it, Gary says, surely there must be some good stuff about the future. Persa, yes, you cockeyed optimist. I started to say the human race will continue to develop its mental abilities over the centuries. You know from the course that individuals, as they undo the ego and gain more of the power of the mind, can develop abilities that may be quite startling to them. As the mind's awareness increases, so does the brain capacity of the being using it. That's merely a reflection of what's going on in the mind. For example, because you love dolphins, you know they use twice as much of their brain capacity as humans do, 20% as opposed to 10%. That's a function of their superior awareness. Gary, the native Hawaiians have always believed that dolphins can read your thoughts and know what your intentions are and can even tell what kind of a person you are. Everything I've seen from being with them, both in captivity and in the wild, swimming and playing with them, tells me it's true. Artin, yes it is. Even though dolphins have their own language, which humans can't figure out even with computers, much of their communication is even more advanced. They communicate by mental telepathy with each other, and just as you said, they can read your thoughts and know whether you're peaceful or full of mental conflict. They avoid those who are in conflict unless it's to help save someone from drowning, knowing it's the conflict that leads to violence, and they gravitate to gentle beings. You've noticed how much they love Cindy. Gary, yeah, it's like she's a goddess to them. Even if we're on the side of the water, they come right up to her. They like me too, but she's the main attraction. And she talks to them and they respond with love. They'll even shoot a little bit of water right up to her nose to say hello. Last time we were on Oahu, we went to the Kahala Hotel to say hello to them and a tropical storm was coming. The wind was blowing about 40 miles per hour and you could tell it was going to get bad. We went up to the dolphins and even though they weren't sticking their heads above the water except to take a breath every few minutes, which they have to because they're mammals, they came right up to be with us. One of them stayed underwater right near us, like he was meditating, head down and still under the water, tail on the bottom and body down. We'd never seen anything like it. Anyway, we stayed with them so long, we were lucky to make it back to the place where we were staying that night before the storm hit full force. It wasn't a hurricane, but it was still pretty crazy. Arden, dolphins, not humans, are the most intelligent beings on your planet. But since they lack thumbs and fingers, they don't make tools, and they wouldn't make weapons if they could. As the centuries go on, however, people will develop the ability to communicate like dolphins. They'll be able to use mental telepathy. Of course, there are alien races that already do that. Humans will also acquire that skill. Gary, if that's true, then by definition, aren't you saying that the human mind will grow in its awareness, that people are going to become more intelligent and more advanced, and that, therefore, the human race will become better in general? Persa, on the one hand, yes. But don't forget you live in a universe of duality. As long as the ego appears to exist, you'll have setbacks and tragedy. Nothing comes easy with the ego unless it's to trick you into complacency. In your everyday dream world, the human race will have to go through great struggles just to survive. Gary, I was starting to feel good for a minute there. Thanks for snapping me out of it. Persep, you know where true joy is found, brother. What's one of your favorite quotes from the Course, the one about joy? Gary, oh yeah, how else can you find joy in a joyless place except by realizing that you are not there? And that's actually the title of one of the video webinars that was presented by the folks at Foundation for Course in Miracles before they moved to Henderson, Nevada recently. And a tip of the hat to those folks that hopefully will continue to you know, share again. But anyway, I really enjoyed that one because it was, I think that title alone says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I just wanted to say something before you go on here. First off, I apologize. I completely lost track of my time. I don't know what I was thinking. I had just gotten off a call with some other folks. But this thing about the dolphins, I don't know if you read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
I did. Yes. In fact, I recall the humor of Douglas Adams' writing where he said that the dolphins were the second most intelligent species on the planet, humans being the third, and his comment was the mice were the most intelligent because they were actually doing experiments on us, and we thought, and had us convinced it was the other way around, something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought that was pretty funny. Yeah.
It's very, very funny. But also, a long, long time ago, and maybe you've seen this, I read a book. It's called The Illuminatus Trilogy.
I guess I haven't.
Well, you look it up. It's a huge book. It's like, well, it's a trilogy. So, it goes from everything from the Kennedy assassination to everything. But in that, the dolphins are also the most intelligent and actually do a lot of things in the world that we don't know about. But when I'm reading all this stuff about the dolphins with the Gary book, I get that completely. And dolphins themselves, they hypothesize that they were actually land animals, and they actually have like five fingers. If you look at the bone, the skeletal structure of a dolphin's fins, they have actually five fingers. But it evolved to fins so they could swim. There's a lot of speculation that they were the dominant animal on the planet. They were the dominant beings on the planet before we came along, and they recognized that living on the on the earth was much more difficult than living in the ocean. So they went back to the ocean, and we stupidly decided to stay here and try to make a go of it with buildings and farms and all that kind of stuff. So,
well, it's a challenge in any dualistic system, regardless of the particulars, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Since you mentioned, the cetaceans in general, the dolphins and the whales, there's a couple of things that I've always thought it pretty interesting is, and this, the first one is actually from years ago, if you remember the Carl Sagan Cosmos series when that first aired on PBS. I don't know if you watched those or not, but I thought they were great, had a lot of fun and good insights in there. And one of the episodes, he talked about how before the advent of motorized, ocean-going vessels, where it was all just sailing ships prior to that, whales literally had a global communication system because their subaudible communication, the very low frequency sounds, literally could circumnavigate the globe. So literally they could have a conversation with all of their species at once around the globe. Well, not once simultaneously, but the speed of sound in water is, I think, significantly faster than in air. But it still takes a finite amount of time. But I thought it was fascinating that up until, motorized boats, basically, whales could hear each other around the planet. I mean, that's pretty amazing. sort of also doesn't lead for much privacy if that was your goal, but maybe they recognized that the folly of private thoughts and separate thinking, anyway. And then another thing was, years ago my wife and I started a group called New Frontiers of the Gold Country, and one of the speakers was Tom Kenyon. I don't know if you've heard of
him. I have, yes.
But, he got into some of the scientific research around the dolphins in particular and, cetacean communication and how they're, communicate holographically. And even the ultrasonic, sonar that they use, apparently their brains have sections in them that are capable of creating mental images of their surroundings, with their eyes closed that are so accurate they could, pick up like the thickness of a dime from quite a ways away because of the interference pattern holography, essentially from the interference of the sound waves creating a holographic image in their brains where they basically can map out their environment very, very carefully and very, on a very fine level of detail.
Wow.
As well as, using holographic technology that we may not understand. but just the fact that even on the level that we can sort of get is, they're able to create an image, you know, I guess using brainwave analysis somehow. I don't know how they did that, but figured out that they were able to, you know, using their sonar, create a picture of their environment that's, you know, it'd be like if I was maybe to make a few sounds out of my mouth and know exactly what's in the room in every direction around me, not just in what's right in front of me.
Wow.
That's kind of cool. You know, for
that is very cool. And you know, it reminds me of I'm putting a link here into the chat for you. It reminds me of a kind of a meditation that I do and that I find very, very helpful. And you know, maybe you know, you might try it, or maybe you already do something like this. But preferably I'm doing this outside. But you know, I'm just sitting and I'm focusing on, first I focus on what's to the front of me, to what's behind me, to the right, to the left, uh-huh. above, below, and I just expand my consciousness into that space. And as I expand my consciousness into that space, I'm expanding down through the earth to, you know, to the other side and expanding out into the galaxy as far as I can go. And as I'm focusing on that in this meditation, I'm just becoming more and more connected with all things. And I literally have the experience of having like a map of the world around me. I feel it. And a really great place to do that is on an airplane. I've done it on an airplane a couple of times, and that's even better because it's like you're floating in space and you're the center of the universe, and you have you know what's behind you. You know everything about your place in space. You know, I go through the rooms below and the basement and, you know, through the buildings and, you know, really it's a mental sonar. But I'm doing it by reaching out that way. So, you know, that's an amazing thing that, you know, they can navigate with that. And I'm sorry that we ruined the oceans for them so that they lost that form of communication. They're going to have
our interpreters are saying, you know, the challenge, of course, is to remember that with each advance, there's, you know, step forward, step back kind of thing, because that's the dualistic nature of this world, is that, you know, once one environmental disaster is cleaned up, another one, you know, steps in and takes its place kind of thing. But at the same time, you know, the important thing is not to stop doing the things we can to make this world better, but just to remember that this isn't our true home. And I think that ties into the quote that Gary and I both like that he's commenting here, you know, the way you find joy in a joyless place is by realizing you're not there, and that our identity is truly is a mental one, and that mental one really has the choice between the spiritual and the physical, and the physical is really just an inadequate strategy for dealing with a system of projection that doesn't work. Whereby we made up an entire cosmos, including planets with water and cetaceans and land masses and humans and the whole gamut of stuff that we, you know, we think occupies this little, you know, set of concentric spheres that we believe what we would call biological life is able to exist on this little rotating ball of molecules, you know, all that stuff anyway. But, you know, it's just, a massive hologram that, is, you know, just fabricated. I actually, since you mentioned Hitchhiker's Guide, there was, the movie that they had, about that. They showed where they were rebuilding the earth, and they had all these little, scaffoldings, you know, on a massive scale, you know, they're covered, you know, thousands of miles, and they were showing all these pieces being put together to build a new earth kind of thing. And, you know, the sci-fi, very humorous sci-fi story, but it just kind of, you know, it's sort of like, you know, taking the Truman Show on a massive scale, you know, is that we're making this all up, you know, and I thought it was a great metaphor for the idea that, you know, like the bumper sticker says, you know, never trust an atom. They make everything up, you know.
I love it. Well, and then another thing I wanted to mention too, as we're talking in the book about the progress of the human race and us becoming more and more evolved and all of these things, understand that this is all metaphor. There is no future. There is no 100 years from now. 100 years from now exists at this very moment. Everything that ever is or ever would be in the illusion was made at once and has not changed.
Right.
And all the thing that's changing is our perception of it. So as we are perceiving it linearly through time, so we're, you know, horizontally going along. And like I say, one of my favorite metaphors that I use is that we are in the universe museum, and each room in the museum has a certain kind of, life that's going on. And so my life right now, our lives right now appear to be in this, you know, modern world with all this technology. But we can go from this room to the next room, and it could be we're living on Mars in the next room. And we could go into the next room, and it could be we're living in pioneer days. We can go into the next room, and we're living in
pioneer-based days. It could be a slapstick world.
It could be a slapstick. You imagine that you made that one up, okay? When we get there, I'm going to blame you.
I'm going for lemon meringue and then pecan pie once in a while, too.
A little key lime. Key lime is my favorite.
Key lime, there you go.
We'll get there. But,
for stretchy apples, not bad either.
Whatever you can imagine, you're not making up new imagination of pie world. You're actually...
And we know pi r round. People say pi r square, but pi r round, we know that's...
Pi r round, exactly. But as we're going through these worlds, remember... They are in the museum already.
Right.
They're not being invented. We're not building a new wing on the museum. We're not building a new floor on the museum. It's already there. And all we're doing is going through and looking at it. So, it sounds like we're talking about a linear progression in time. But there's no such thing as a linear progression of time. Time is all now. In this very moment. So the only thing that we are doing is we're seeing it in bit parts. We're seeing little bit parts of it.
Yeah.
And maybe we have 100 years of a bit part.
I was just going to say, I love your museum metaphor. And I was thinking about those Night at the Museum movies and what, you know, to further that metaphor that we think that all these, you know, mastodons and Neanderthals have come to life and, you know, creatures from Americas and Europe's and whatever, you know, history like those movies depict. But if that's just our imagination, we're just having a dream, like, you know, nocturnal fantasy of all these things being animated. But these things were, you know, gone and over long ago. So we're just really, we're spending time in an animated museum. Only in a dream state, and all these are metaphors. And just one concluding comment on metaphors is I think that if we can learn to not find grievances about anything that appears in this world, and to recognize that anytime we get upset or angry with something that appears to be happening in this museum, we're forgetting one of the principal ideas of A Course in Miracles, and that's I'm never upset for the reason I think, because it's all about the illusion. So we can adopt the Will Rogers school of metaphysics, which is I never metaphor I didn't like, right? So.
That was a long setup.
It was.
And it was very, very informational, too. I love it. Yeah, I never metaphor I didn't like. But what about fives and sixes?
Oh, there you go. Well, with the Victor Borge's inflationary language, it would be I never met a five I didn't like, I guess, right?
So, that's right. Yeah. And do you know why all of the numbers are afraid of seven? Because 789.
789, that's right. Now I remember that one. Yes, yes.
Stay away from him. All right. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
The cannibal number.
Yeah. So I'll continue to read. And,
probably a good thing. Yeah, we probably should go on. Yeah. Do you want to back up to that sentence? To
yes.
Pass? Yeah.
So, Persis said, you know where true joy is found, brother. What is one of your favorite quotes from the Course, the one about joy? Gary, oh, yeah. How else can you find joy in a joyless place except by realizing that you are not there? We're not there. We're in a freaking museum. We think we're living the life of Little Home on the Prairie. So remember, Arden, remember where your true happiness is. You are doing it, Gary. You can go all the way. You can do it in this lifetime, and so can Cindy. Not that you have to do it together, but I get the sense that you both decided recently that you're going to go for it in this lifetime and not wait for the next one. We were hoping that would be the case with you. Not that you have to, but because of a question we asked you a long time ago. How long do you want to prolong your suffering? And I'm just going to aside on this because, you know, this is the enigma here that you have to come to understand is because in this same museum is every world that ever was. The real world is there as well. And the world of Arden and Persa is there, and the world of Gary and Cindy is there, and the world of Jesus and Buddha is there, and all of those worlds are in the same museum. You can go into it anytime you want to. But people wonder, how can Gary and Cindy become awakened in this lifetime when they're supposed to later on, when they're Arden and Persa? Because it's all happening at the same time. You are already awake. We are already enlightened. We don't know it because we're wandering around through this museum thinking that we're wandering in the dark and we don't know where we're at. And it's all our own thinking. But we are already in the real world because the real world is the museum, in the museum. It's all part of the dream. And you can't make the dream real. But you can believe that it's real, and you can suffer if you want to. So when Arden says, how long do you want to prolong your suffering, that just says to me, you know, do I want to wait another lifetime? Do I want to wait 10 lifetimes? Or do I want to do it now? I want to do it now. Why not? Because it's not going to change history. History is already history. So, you know, all it's going to do is take me from this part of the museum into a part of the museum that's more friendly or more joyful or less dangerous or less fearful or whatever. In fact, no matter where I am, when this happens, I am in heaven. So I'm already in the best place, the good place,
exactly.
Which is back on now.
The gentle awakening is really where it's at, huh? Because the Course reminds us that we're not going to be able to wake up from, you know, that panicky, threatened, fearful, terrified place that the ego is the ego's home. And that we have to basically slowly but surely release our white-knuckled grip on that dysfunctional thought system. You know, as Ken Wapnick so eloquently puts his favorite phrase, you know, the maladaptive solution to the non-existent problem. We have to be willing to look at the suffering that we believe we deserve because we thought we shattered perfect oneness with our mind and then made up a whole universe to try to play fugitive from justice in a made-up dysfunctional universe populated with all these things that we've been talking about this last hour. Sometimes it seemed to go our way, in quotes, and sometimes it seemed not to go our way. But that's only because there's a we and a they, and that's part of the insanity. That's one of the fundamental premises of one or the other. There's the bedrock of the ego's thought system that is just a silly misunderstanding that we took seriously, the tiny man idea, huh?
So. Absolutely. That's just it. And we can change our mind right now.
Exactly. So you want to read on?
Okay, yes. So, Gary, Art just asked him, how long do you want to prolong your suffering? Gary, I have to admit, I haven't been affected as much by things in the world, except a little by the presidential election. It's hard, you know, because I was brought up on politics. When I was 9 years old, I lived in Massachusetts, and JFK was a hero of mine. JFK was a big hero of mine, too. I was a Catholic Democrat when I was a kid, so he was like God. I started following politics early and learned a lot about it. I still know more than most people, including a lot of politicians. I almost went into it as a profession. Whoa. Today, I'm glad I didn't. There is no civility anymore. No human decency. Not that presidential elections haven't always been full of lies and hatred, but at least it was usually more subtle. Today, the inmates are running the asylum. Washington, D.C. is a joke. It's not possible to govern, and I don't like that. Cindy and I went into D.C. a few months ago. We were doing a workshop in Manassas, Virginia, where the first major land battle of the Civil War took place, and it was an easy ride in. I loved being at the National Mall, the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Memorial, the Capitol, the Martin Luther King Memorial, and the White House. It was really cool. Those places are a lot more impressive in person. You don't get the scale of them on TV or in the movies. Anyway, I found myself wishing our government could live up to its original intentions. Our founding fathers weren't perfect, but they were very interesting men, many of them Masons. Today, interesting is about the last word I'd use to describe most of the politicians in Washington. Artem, I understand how you feel, Gary. I used to be a human too, remember? But don't forever forget what Jay tells you in the course. Quote, there's no point in lamenting the world, unquote. You know now that what everything is for, and if it's politics that affects you most, then it's politics that you have to forgive the most. Be as determined as you possibly can be, and you'll succeed. Persa, you mentioned Manassas. The Civil War is one of the most graphic examples of the ego at work. First of all, it involved the issue of slavery, which immediately goes to the ego making bodies real. Some bodies are a different color than others, which is right up the ego's alley. At that time, some bodies were considered to be more valuable than others and to have rights that others didn't. Some people considered their bodies to be their personal property. The ego loves differences and will always tempt people to use them for judgment and projection. Second, the war involved states and states' rights. At that time, it was more important what state you were from than what country you were from. Most people never traveled far from their homes, and they took great pride in being from places like Ohio, Massachusetts, Maine, Texas, or Virginia. But what is a state but a separation idea? It's the same with countries. They're just a separation idea. When you see the video of the Earth from space, do you see any borders? Gary, no. That's because God, in his infinite wisdom, decided to let us establish our own borders and then defend them to the death as a test of our courage on the gridiron. And, of course, to see who could beat out other people. Why do you think they call us the human race? Bursa says, you need a nap. As you know, God in his infinite wisdom is still home having a good time, and a lot of people thought they were here fighting the Civil War. The conflict in the mind was screaming for fulfillment, even though Abraham Lincoln was hoping that what he thought of as, quote, the better angels of our nature would prevail. There was no way. Before you knew it, your nation was attempting suicide. By the time it was over, counting both the North and South, almost 750,000 soldiers were dead. The official count is lower, but this number is accurate. In many places, every man in town under the age of 40 was dead. There were more Americans killed than in the World War I and World War II combined. Yes, World War II was the most destructive war in history by far because it involved many of the most populous countries all over the world. But America would never see anything like the Civil War again. It was one of the ego's most flaming accomplishments, seething with insanity. Gary, knowing you, you have a reason for bringing this up. Artem, several reasons. America hasn't changed as much as some people may think when it comes to racism. You know what? I think I'm going to let you read this because I'm getting tired of reading.
Okay.
So if you don't mind.
I was just thinking, no kidding, to that last sentence.
I know.
I'll back it up. Darton, several reasons. America hasn't changed as much as some people may think when it comes to racism. Racism never went away. It just went underground. The point of all of this is that despite all the death and horror, despite all the pseudo-resolution of the problems through war, despite all the great work being done by people throughout the civil rights and human rights movements, the ego hasn't changed. It's been undone in some people who are on the path, but certainly not the masses. You can't change the ego by trying to fix the world. That won't solve the problem. So there's just as much racism and prejudice as there was 150 years ago. Yes, it's taken on different forms, but the ego's sordid game of conflict, separation, and division still remains for all to see, just as pathetic as ever. Gary, that's true. I thought when Obama got elected, it meant a great step forward for America. Finally, we had a black president. And what happened? All these nuts came out of the woodwork. We, quote, we want our country back, they'd say, unquote. Unquote, they'd say. What they meant was that they wanted to go back to the 1950s when it was okay to hate people who look different from you. Quote, make America great again, unquote, a campaign slogan coined by a deeply disturbed man really means, quote, make America racist again, unquote. He even questioned Obama's legitimacy as president, claiming he was born in Kenya. How racist can you get? So can you not make it real and forgive him? There's the question du jour in anyone who happens to have any kind of social media, electronic communication device, newspaper, magazine, whatever. There's just so much that we're inundated with in the political spectrum, especially as we're approaching another election cycle. Another election. Okay, Gary, of course, it's not him. He's just being his toxic-minded ego self. What bothers me is that there are so many people in this country who actually voted for him. That's the hard part. It's sick. And it tells me we're in a sick country. Persa, not totally sick. You're a partly sick country that also has a right mind. And this is a partly sick world that also has a right mind. The Holy Spirit is available to everyone, but eventually everyone will need to forgive all the world. There's the clue right there, isn't it?
That's it.
Sooner or later, we all need to forgive everything, to generalize, to go home together where we never left. That's because as long as you have a conflict in the mind, you know what it leads to. Art, of course, the ego keeps raising the bar and trying to make it harder for you. The internet, which can be used for wonderful purposes, is also used to spread hatred. And the hatred of the bigots isn't directed only at those with a different skin color. Your country has made much progress in passing laws and achieving court decisions that ban discrimination against the LGBT community. But the hatred is still there. The tragedy of 49 people being murdered in the Pulse nightclub in Orlando serves to highlight what will continue to happen as long as you combine guns and hatred. The ego has set up America very well, and the right wing will continue to make the most of it for their selfish purposes. Gary, I know. The Republican state legislatures are always trying to pass laws that discriminate against anyone who isn't a white Republican. Imagine, and this really pisses me off, passing laws that are clearly intended to stop black people from voting. How can they sleep at night? How can they call themselves Americans? How can they dishonor all those who have died for democracy and the right to vote? And how can those who can vote empower these mentally ill local politicians? Okay. Good rhetorical questions.
Yes, first
response.
Yeah, and if you're asking these questions, let's hear what Perpa has to say.
Okay, that usually covers everything we were likely to say, right, Linda?
Yeah.
Okay, Perpa. That's because on the level of form, bigotry, misogyny, and racism are still alive and well in America, and in the rest of the world. Even today, women don't get equal pay for equal work and are treated as inferior to men by their corporate bosses. Yeah, that, I mean, that still strikes me as equally crazy that, you know, the Equal Rights Amendment, you know, has never passed in this country. It's like, what? Okay. Anybody who isn't a rich white male is at one time or another in their lives relegated to the position of a second class citizen. And now you have the immigration issue being raised to the hilt, giving the ego more people to hate. Again, as always, as I know Persa and Artin and the intent of Gary's writing this is to remind us that the idea is not to make differences real, but to look beyond to the essence that we all share, where the cause of differences makes no sense and is dropped when we recognize our intrinsic oneness, and we get there by looking at our intrinsic sameness and looking past the imaginary differences that only appear in the dream of form, huh?
Exactly. And you know, I just want to say it. Now, I was on another call earlier, and they were asking questions about how do we see everything as the same? You know, where Jesus says, make this year different by making it all the same. Mm-hmm. And he emphasizes throughout the course about seeing sameness. Mm-hmm. And when you are seeing the world in this, you know, all these differences, all these craziness, all this things I don't like, all the things I do like, all this differences, if that's what I'm focusing on, then I'm going to see insanity. But if I'm focusing on what is the same, even if it's the same in the world of the ego, if I know that you're afraid and I'm afraid, I can have a kind of an empathy with you because we are experiencing the same emotion or the same fear, the same worry or the same upset. I've been watching television the last couple of days. I'm sure a lot of other people have, and there's been some controversial stuff going on about the Supreme Court. This person who's been nominated, and it's so easy to look at this person and just say, "Oh my gosh, this is a horrible person," and you know they don't deserve to be on the Supreme Court, or they you know, and looking at them as a character, an ego, a being that has all these flaws and failures, you know, it's so easy to condemn a person who has those flaws and failures, except that I ask, as Jesus asked us, would I accuse myself of this? Mm-hmm. And actually, he's really asking me to accuse myself of this and look to see the truth of it. And I see that I am flawed and filled with failures, and that I am, you know, I want to murder people, and I want to, you know, I'm doing the same thing. I may be thinking I'm being self-righteous about it all, and that it, you know, I'm better because, you know, at least, you know, I didn't do this, or at least I intend for things to be good. But, you know, I think this person also intends for things to be good. I think this person wants to have a happy world. I think this person wants their family to be safe. I think this person wants the same thing I want. They just have a different understanding of how to get there. Mm-hmm. And so it's not the need for safety and camaraderie and all the things that we have needs for. It's the way that we achieve the fulfillment of those needs. Right. And so, you know, if that's all.
And the way being the thought system, right? I mean, yeah. which thought system? Yeah.
Exactly. It's choosing which thought system. And honestly, when I see a person that's in, I mean, I watched this man who was tormented. You could see that he was in great fear, and you know, everyone seemed to be in great fear on both sides. Sure. And looking at that and thinking, you know, I could see peace instead of this.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I could see forgiveness instead of this. Right. And who is responsible for what I see?
There's lots of calls for love happening, and our media certainly is not, shortchanged in the abundance of those. I try to remember that every seeming individual has those three components of the mind. We have a decision-making faculty. We have a right mind and an insane mind, and we're constantly choosing between those two. And the only thing that you know is any kind of a faulty but hopefully somewhat useful indicator of our sanity is how often, you know, statistically do we choose the sane thought system relative to the insane one. And you know, obviously everybody has gone back and forth, otherwise we wouldn't be here. I mean, we all answered yes to the ego's, you know, call for volunteers of, you know, is this a private fight or can anyone join in? And we all step forward, you know, to be in this dream. So that now our challenge is to undo that decision by generalizing our learning in the forgiveness classroom and seeing every opportunity, including, you know, the political stuff that parades across our TV and computer screens and whatnot, and phones and everything, all that, and just say, wow, that's an opportunity for me to see calls for love and you know, someone exactly like myself in truth, that I would not accuse myself of the guilt that appears to be there, nor the, you know, the victimhood, because in truth nothing happened, and that's the only basis where forgiveness will work. Mm-hmm. I've been reading an advanced copy of Jackie Laura Jones's new book, which is really quite good, and I'm just 40 pages or so into it, and she goes into, you know, the foundation for real forgiveness and shares it quite eloquently. Jackie being Cindy Laura Renard's sister, and so they teach together quite a bit, and they're both great teachers in their own right. In addition to Gary, so anyway, but yeah, that's all these things, quick aside there. I think people will enjoy Jackie Laura Jones's book when it comes out in a few weeks. What's that, Lynn?
I said thanks for that plug.
Oh sure, yeah. Anyway, but yeah, it all gets back to, you know, we have these three, you know, things: the decision-making faculty, and then the sane and the insane thought systems, and everybody is doing that same game. We're doing that same dance between the two, you know, polarized ways of thinking, and only one of them is going to lead us beyond polarity to out of the dream to the state of mind where we ultimately realize that none of this had any impact on our complete and untouchable innocence, that everyone, every single being of any variety that we can imagine is completely innocent of anything that happened in a dream. So.
Yeah, exactly. And we are the miracle workers. I know you are. I know I am, because we have this blue book and we talk about it and we read it and we have dedicated our lives to it. So we are the miracle workers. We are not the workers of the illusion and the ego. We have a certain function and a job here. And, you know, part of that is just not to get caught up in the fearful teachings of the world and accusations of guilt, accusations of being less. Being different, you know, these are all things that come up when the ego sees these activity going on. And, you know, my job is to say no, you know, no, I don't believe it. It's not true. So it looks like our time is up. Thank you so much, Bruce. And once again,
likewise, Lynn.
Birthday to you. And I will mark this page and maybe we'll start actually back at the, what the heck? Maybe at the top of the page.
Yeah,
sounds next good. Next week. So
well, have a great week, everyone, and keep on forgiving.
that's right. Keep on forgiving. All right. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. Will you stay on the line for a minute? I have a question.
Sure, sure.
But I'm going to let go of the mic and hang up on the other computer here.
All right, sure. Thanks. Hi, everyone. Thanks, you guys. Nice. Yeah. You know, it's... You just gotta laugh. I watch the TV.